Mr. Charlie Kirk is the director of RENISA NPC. I want to begin with the to give a broad overview of what is at stake here. And as the slide indicates, it's all represented also in the submissions. But this is the shorter version to try and get in within 15 minutes. And that is that a green economy or a circular economy is a radically innovative way of both protecting the environment while at the same time creating a self-sustaining industry and jobs that collect and process waste. And really, what this circular economy is about is turning something without value, namely waste, into something with value. And in order to do that, it requires a legislative scheme under which an independent entity is responsible for the creation of the industry, not just remediation of waste, but the creation of an industry in which the state bears no financial responsibility. The producers of the waste provide the funds, but the state, of course, has supervisory power to ensure the implementation and financial propriety. The plan approved by the Minister of Environmental Affairs under the Waste Act seeks to do just that, to create a self-sustaining industry over time in which tires are collected, stored, and processed. It takes on the environmental responsibility of producers of waste. I think that's really important for what I'm going to argue in a moment. It takes on their responsibility, and on their behalf establishes small businesses, cooperatives, to collect, transport, store, and process waste tire. And of course it is funded by those producers, who in turn pass some of that cost onto tire dealers and car users, truck users. Important to recognize about the plan is that it is renewable for periods of 5 years. If one looks at section 12.1 of the waste tire regulation, unfortunately it looks like it's stuck. But I'm just seeing if someone can help. The plan is renewable for periods of 5 years. The waste tire regulation states in section 12.1 that the plan must be revisited and resubmitted for approval by the minister at 5 year period, or sooner if required. But the point is this, that what's critical to understand is that this is a long-term program. The plan provides targets, and I think this is important, and restricts us diverting waste tires from dumps. That's the environmental target. Establishing small black businesses, transporters, depot owners, processors, and jobs, pickers and employees of the small businesses. So let's move to the next slide and look at the diversion of waste tire. At the commencement of this plan in 2012, only 4% of waste tires were diverted from landfill. Today, over 60% are being diverted from landfill as a result of the plan. Now, in order for RENISA NPC to do this, it has to establish and contract with cooperatives, transporters to collect waste tires, depots to store them, and processors to process those tires. And in the 3 years that it has been in existence, it has created over 3,000 jobs, over 200 small, medium-sized enterprises, of which, and these figures, by the way, the ones that are 22, 76, and 74 on the slide, are ones taken from the PwC external audit as of December. But currently, there are 25 depots established, of which, as you can see, 21, 22 are black-owned. 76 transporters, of which 75 are black-owned. There are now 120 transporters. And 74 micro-collector cooperatives. And you can begin to see this is a very large network requiring an enormous amount of administration. And the supply and customer are 16 recycling processes. The vision that informs the release of plan has been ready It will have to alter its contracting period, which will lead to an unwillingness to invest, particularly in the processing sector. And the lack of certainty will hamper the full realization of both its environmental and non-environmental obligations under the plan. Those obligations haven't changed. Now, what's the reason for the change? Treasury has made it clear that the fees paid in terms of the approved plan are, as far as they're concerned, a tax for the following reasons. No fee is authorized, they say, by the legislation. No, the fee is compulsory, and there's no quid pro quo, no reciprocal benefits for the fee paid. I'm missing a slide, but the... we have two senior councils of opinion. Sorry, this is missing a slide. Two senior councils of opinion. The copies of those are on the Rhodesia's website, and the URL is in the submission. Those senior council opinions, okay, state number one, it is authorised. Right? It's authorised by the Waste Hire Regulations, Regulation 12, I and J. Secondly, it is not compulsory, because if you look at the Waste Hire Regulations and the structure of the Waste Act, what is compulsory is to belong to a plan. So any producer can opt out and establish a plan of their own. They're obliged to belong to a plan or establish one of their own. So it's not compulsory. And the third is that there's no quid pro quo, but it's providing a service for a fee. And what is the service? The service is collecting the waste fires on behalf of producers. It is storing them in a safe depot. And thirdly, it is processing those waste fires. In other words, the quid pro quo is as follows. It's a fee to discharge their environmental obligation under the Waste Act and the Waste Hire Regulations. Now,
Thank you. financial advisors have various reporting obligations, for example, to the Financial Intelligence Centre and also under the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors, as well as other reporting requirements. And if they don't have a safe harbor, they cannot actually engage with their clients and start having these discussions because they have to report their clients as soon as they formally engage with them. We propose that accountants, lawyers, financial institutions should be covered. Financial institutions have a very wide reach with these kind of matters, but they will be very reluctant to engage if a safe harbor is not provided. And we think that this is really a critical success factor because people won't even start talking about this without having this protection. The period for applications at the moment is proposed to be from the 1st of October for 6 months until the end of March. That's starts a month from now. And it's a very tight period if we are really going to have all this documentation required for 5 years. And as we said previously, there are a number of amnesties running at the moment, so that will be slowing down the process even further. We do propose that the application period should run for a year, and especially if the five-year calculation will still be required. There's a slight concern among taxpayers that the special VDT doesn't apply to amounts that have been disclosed to SARS under an international agreement, but they don't know when an amount has been disclosed to SARS. So our point here really is that SARS must directly advise the taxpayer that the information has been disclosed to me and therefore you will no longer qualify before that that exclusion can apply. And then just the last point is there is room for error in this whole process and bona fide errors given the kind of information that needs to be obtained and the difficulty with that. And there is a concern that SARS can review and challenge applications at a later date, thereby undermining all the protections sought. So we recommend that good faith protection should be provided. Thank you very much.
Next is, I think, the Chartered Accountants. Thank you. Welcome, Chandi. No, I really, as I said, you can talk. I mean, it's human. It's just when somebody was talking loudly last week, that's intrusive. It's fine. And Kula, I'm not a policeman, really. I'm not a policeman. We're all adults here. One can talk. I don't think anywhere in the world can you expect when tax issues are being discussed that members are going to have rapt attention. You go to the UK Parliament, you think they sit there and they even understand some of the things you say. No. So let me assure you, we take everything you say very seriously. We have Antonia Manamela. We have I was welcome, by the way. Sean Muller has left PBO. He's lecturing now at UOJ. And we have Gloria Nguni. If you can just make an Amandla salute, please. That was a joke. PBO is independent. Don't reveal yourself. Now, we also have a young man here. Just introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, members. My name is Panga Mukumba. I generally work for PMG, but I'm acting as an amicus curiae for the committee, offering my services and research and tax specifically.
The Tax Association has, for Dumasani's prodding, offered us help. And I've been a bit cautious about it because of the conflict of interest and so on. Whereas this young man is a student. You're not working for any company. So I have, in principle, said he can work with Dumasani. So just so the committee knows, he's a student. He's finishing off, and I think he's going out of the country in December sometime. Right, so he's assured me, and we looked him up. There's no company that he's involved in. Whereas with the tax association, it's a bit difficult. I'm not implying you're a professional association, but then your members serve different companies and so on. So we're a bit cautious. Nothing to do with you. It's to protect our integrity. as a parliament, we can't. But thanks for your help. Dumasani, we need to pursue that matter further, right? For the tax association and the slightly conflictual relationship that would arise if we took a researcher from there. But I will connect you with this young man. You are the one. Thank you very much. Over to you. Introduce yourself and go for it.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is David Warnicker, and I'll be doing the presentation on behalf of SAICA. I think before I start, I should point out that we did do a more detailed submission in this to National Treasury. So we have other points, but for sake of brevity, we've confined our presentation today to the most, what we see as the most important and critical issues. And here's just on the slide a summary of the issues I'll be talking to this morning. The one, and some of these have already been covered in the previous presentation by SAICA. The adequacy of the time period for the CDP we think is too short. Advisors have got reporting obligations, and as things presently stand, would in most cases actually have to report any inquirer to various bodies, which would undermine the VDP process entirely. Obtaining of the market value of the offshore assets is both a time-consuming and a costly process, which might dissuade people from taking up the special VDP. And then we've identified various inconsistencies between the exchange control VDP and the tax VDP. They don't speak to each other in a number of ways. So just looking in more detail at those. So the proposed time period, which in terms of the special VDP is proposed to be 6 months, we believe is too short. If you compare it with the previous VDPs and amnesties that have been offered, the 2010 VDP ran for a period of 12 months, the 2006 one ran for 10 months, and the 2003-2004 ran for 9 months. And the problem really is that there's so much information that's required to make an application. So for instance, obtaining the market values of offshore assets 6 times over in many cases, which I'll speak to a little bit later, but that would be a time-consuming process. In addition to that, of course, there's the issue that potential VDP applicants would normally seek advice as to whether they would qualify and on what basis they would qualify and so forth, and that would take time as well to prepare before they decide to make an application. So if we look at the 2010 VDP, it took 3 years. This should be not to collect all the information. Actually, the slide has got an error, but to go through all the applications took a long period of time from the Reserve Bank's perspective. And as I mentioned, to do the market valuations 5 times over historically is a time-consuming process, so it would take away greatly from the time that would be available then to apply. Because as currently worded, one's got to submit all of that information together with your application. And we believe that in order to encourage as many people to come forward as possible, it would be better to give more time. So we recommend that the application period should be increased to at least 12 months. We also note that the explanatory memorandum to the bill says that one of the objectives here is to allow taxpayers to regularise their affairs before the reporting period for the common reporting standards comes into effect. and that would be September 2017. So if one allowed the special VDP to open on the 1st of October and go through till the end of August or possibly September, it would give almost 11 or 12 month period, which would be more realistic for people to regularize their affairs. And then if a short period of time is going to be retained, which we recommend isn't retained, then we believe that it should at least be made possible that applicants can submit a high-level application with possibly the valuations and further details to follow later once those are obtained. But as presently worded, it might disqualify somebody from applying altogether if you don't have all of the valuations, for instance, over a 5 or 6 year period at the end of each tax year available and submitted via the application. And then with regard to the obligation to report inquiries, the success of the special VDP would depend on one's ability to obtain advice from professionals, because lay people are very unlikely to just go off their own bat without seeking advice. It's unrealistic to expect that. But in terms of current law, registered auditors, who usually are also chartered accountants, in terms of the Audit Professions Act, have a duty to report audit clients of theirs where there's been a contravention. And then in terms of the Financial Intelligence Centre Act, persons who are accountable institutions, like for instance banks and brokers, would also have a duty to report to the Financial Intelligence Centre. It's quite widely worded. If they suspect transactions were in contravention of statute, so even the suspicion would give rise to a reporting obligation. And if one looks at Section 29(2) of the Financial Intelligence Centre Act, it seems quite widely worded, and it goes as far as stating that anyone in business who suspects that there was a contravention would have an obligation to report. So it goes very wide indeed, and we're also concerned that it would affect attorneys, because under the Financial Intelligence Centre Act, attorneys are exempted from reporting, provided that the matter enjoys professional privilege. But there appears to be an argument that that the consultation could relate to a possible future contravention and that it might not be privileged. So if one, you know, lives in a small town and there's a chartered accountant and a banker and an attorney, you actually couldn't go and consult with any of those people. And we note that both the 2006 and 2010 VDPs excluded both accountable institutions and registered auditors from the obligation to report in terms of the voluntary disclosure application if it's pursuant to that, which helped undoubtedly in our view to make those programs successful. So our recommendation is that the special VDP should exclude registered auditors and relevant persons covered under FICA from reporting inquiries pursuant to applications under the special VDP. One would need to just consider Section 29(2) of the Financial Intelligence Centre Act to make sure that anyone in business potentially could also have a reporting obligation, and that should also be covered. then determining the market value of overseas assets. So assets must be held or deemed to be held between 1 March 2010 and 28 February 2015 in order to make a person eligible for the VDP, special VDP. And the value of those assets has got to be determined. It's got to be determined in many cases 5 times over for the same asset, because you'd have to value it at the end of each tax year, starting from February 2011 in the case of an individual, 12, 13, 14, and 15. You'd need to get valuations of the market value of the assets held in contravention for each of those 5 tax years. And we believe that's both going to be time consuming and costly, and in many cases unnecessary. Difficult often in the case where one's talking about immovable property, where it's listed securities, it's not really a problem. But the problem comes in where it's an unlisted security, or if it's immovable property. Those are particularly problematic from that point of view. It's uncertain also what type of valuation would be acceptable. Who would be eligible to conduct such a valuation? The taxpayer free to do it? Would a registered valuer in that jurisdiction have to do it? What methodology would they have to follow in order to do the valuation? Also, if there's a dispute later about the valuation that was put forward, would it then disqualify the application for the special VDP? So if you just look at an example of a taxpayer with 2 flats overseas, that potentially would qualify in terms of the VDP, special VDP. So you would have to find out the market value of each flat on those dates. The first one actually in the slide should be February 2011 in 12, 13, 14 and 15. Very difficult to get valuations of assets, historical valuations of assets post the fact. And it's the same problem that arises in the case of unlisted shares. So we've put forward 2 possible proposals for consideration, both of which would necessitate only 1 valuation. And those are that the taxpayer would be able to elect, use a market value in their possession during that period of time, 1 March 2010 to 28 February 2015. The second one being that one simply takes the value or the deemed value at 1 October 2016, which is the date when the special VDP actually commences. And then the last major point that I want to speak about is on inconsistencies between the special VDP for tax and for exchange control. The first issue relates to whether or not one is under investigation from the perspective of FinServ. In that one is generally not informed by the Reserve Bank that one is under investigation. So you might unwittingly then apply for the special VDP, only then to be told later that you don't qualify because you were under investigation, you didn't know about it. And the problem there is that it's going to dissuade people from coming forward and applying in the first place. Under the Tax Administration Act, provision is specifically made whereby if a person is aware of a current audit or investigation by SARS or an impending one, that you can't in general qualify for relief. And we believe that something similar should be put forward here to cater for exchange control. So in other words, One possibility is that if a person, by the date of the application, had been informed that they were the subject of an exchange control investigation or audit, that they then be disqualified, but not otherwise. They should then be able to apply and enjoy the relief provided. So, just as I mentioned, that the problem really is that it's going to dissuade people from coming forward. If they're not certain, if post the fact, they're then not going to get the relief, and they then would have divulged all the information. The second issue is that in addition to the five different valuations under the from the perspective of the tax special VDP, the exchange control special VDP has also got an additional date. So the dates don't speak to each other. There's another date there, the exchange control per the circular that was issued by the Reserve Bank. The date is the 29th of February 2016. So even the taxpayer here in our example earlier would in fact have to get six different valuations. Presumably he'd have to get the valuations done by experts, although it's not entirely clear, especially from the perspective of the tax special VDP, who could do the valuation and on what basis that would be acceptable, and if there's a dispute about that valuation later, whether it would disqualify the application. So we recommend then that the date for the exchange control VDP should match the date required by SARS to obtain the market values. There shouldn't be an additional date in terms of the exchange control special VDP. And then lastly, we recommend that there should be a permanent exchange control voluntary disclosure program introduced, as we have for income tax in the Tax Administration Act. There's a permanent, ongoing voluntary disclosure program where taxpayers can come forward and pay the taxes that they owe such interest and regularize their affairs. We believe that the same should be in place on an ongoing basis from the perspective of exchange control. Also that the penalties under, if there is such a permanent voluntary disclosure program for exchange control, the penalties should be open, they should be transparent, one should know what the penalty regime is that's going to apply. And there shouldn't be a doubling up of penalties twice over for the same offence. And if such a voluntary disclosure program is introduced on a permanent basis for exchange control, we believe that it would be very effective in encouraging taxpayers to come forward and then apply for both the tax and the exchange control relief. And one of the problems with the applications for the tax VDP is it doesn't give any exchange control protection, so it can act then to discourage people from coming forward. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Morning, honourable members. My name is Paul Gehring. I am the tax partner at PKF in Durban. Just going back to where we started with the first exchange control amnesty, just as a comparison for the rates. The foreign exchange rates then are the same as the foreign exchange rates proposed now, but the income tax rates have jumped up dramatically from the 2% that they were then to the 50% of taxable income, so somewhere between 14 and 20% now. So it's a significant movement on the income tax position, but a similar position for the foreign exchange. Now, the initial amnesty was a very good idea for regularization, but its timing, I think, was too early in the process of the changes in the country, and there was a lot of uncertainty as to how this disclosure would be treated and where one would be going forward. And I believe that a significant amount of money was not disclosed in that first amnesty due to those reasons. We then had a 2010 foreign exchange VDP, but this was not linked properly with the income tax, and the income tax was not linked properly with the foreign exchange at that stage. And so we did not get proper levels of disclosure coming through. An opportunity was missed. So this is a positive amnesty in that it's covering both the income tax and the Reserve Bank issues. But the fact that it's not been treated as an amnesty, but as a special VDP, is significant and not just semantical. The problem with that is the level of disclosure being required, the level of accuracy that is being requested of people coming forward in respect of events that might have been 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years before that is being required to be disclosed now is too vast for people to grapple with. And the tax rate is still seen as too high in comparison with that first amnesty. It's also not being done in a fully inclusive manner, with trusts being sort of partially kept out of the loop, and that I don't think helps the process going forward. Key that has been mentioned a few times is the issue of FICA. So when the small business tax amnesty took place in 2006, 2007, there was a clear exemption from FICA whether or not the person took up the small business amnesty or not. Without that, no South African advisors can advise and promote this process. We promoted the first amnesty and the small business amnesty in a significant manner in Durban, regularizing significant amounts of money. We have not been able to do anything active in promoting this amnesty to date, because if somebody asks too many questions, then it's not just a theoretical exercise in an application of the law, but it would have personal consequences, and we would be obliged to report those people, scuttling their ability to claim the special VDP, because we'll have notified SARS already prior to its event. Unless this is dealt with, no South African advisor can deal with the matter. And when one comes to IRBA, as was stated, most of the chartered accountants are also registered auditors, and in 2006, before the exemption came through, in respect of that small business amnesty, IRBA clearly indicated that if you consult on the matter, you will have to deal with the reportable irregularity. So every single company that comes forward will have a reportable irregularity, will have a qualified audit report because they will not have regularized that within 30 days, will have issues with regards to their bankers, issues with regards to their credibility and their creditworthiness, and all of that is counterproductive because we are trying to make these people regularize their affairs and come clean. So in that amnesty, there was an exemption put forward for registered auditors dealing with the IRBA issue. There is no rational reason why both the FICA and the ERBA exemption ought not to have been dealt with in this legislation. And these issues were brought to the attention of National Treasury when we had the detailed workshops on the matter, and ought reasonably to have been taken into account if one wants this to work. If one wants to merely have a law to say you could have done it, but nobody was there to help you, well then that's what we're doing. But if we want people to actively make sure that South Africans regularize their affairs, we need to have this protection mechanism for the advisors. Simplicity. That's all we're really asking in the process. Why do we need to disclose who the facilitators are? What is the purpose of knowing which company took funds out of the country? Do we not just want to know who the holder of that asset is at regularization date and what the market value was at that date and apply a simple formula to it? I would propose that using this 50% basis that SARS is proposing with regards to the corporate tax, use a fixed 14% to regularize the income tax consequences and not have a floating rate depending on whether you're an individual, a company, or a trust. Have a simplicity for the regularization as one has a simplicity with the regularization of the foreign exchange portion of the transaction. VAT seems to have fallen through the cracks. In the first draft, it wasn't mentioned at all. In the second sort of draft, it's specifically mentioned as being out. Everything that we are talking about has the smell of evasion with it. Why must one aspect be dealt with differently to all other aspects when all of it was a form of evasion one way or another? So the process of simplicity and regularization is required if one wants this to work. If one treats VAT separately and makes that go through the normal voluntary disclosure program with another 14% layer and with interest for the last, since the inception of VAT, it's a prohibitive adjustment to be made. The reality is that people will attempt to bury their things deeper in structures, not come forward. South Africa's had nominees on many things over many years, and new nominees will work in this regard. There are ways around common reporting. It's not infallible, but we want to make sure that we broaden the net, bring it in a simplistic manner, and let everybody come and regularize their affairs for the benefit of the whole country. There's no rational reason to exclude all these trusts and to exclude the estate duty provisions which are currently applicable to trusts. In 2003, a mechanism was found to create that legal fiction and bring the foreign trusts into the equation without changing the estate duty implications of that. There's no reason why that ought not to have been the case. And there's no reason why South African local trusts ought not to fall within the parameters of this special voluntary disclosure if we truly want this to be all-inclusive and bring the money in that we need. There's been a failure to deal with provisional tax consequences that will arise as to the adjustment in 2015 and 2016, when both years' second provisional tax payments would have already been finalized without this income. A simple exclusion from provisional tax penalties arising from the income related to the special voluntary disclosure program ought reasonably to have been included. Mention was made earlier that the base cost of the asset ought to be restated at whatever that valuation date value is. That was the position in the 2003 amnesty, where those assets were rebased for capital gains tax purposes at that valuation. If one doesn't do this, then not only does one have to provide the six valuations, but one also has to be able to ascertain what that original cost was, and I don't think all of that is reasonable if we want to go forward. It will certainly make it a very expensive exercise if one has the original amounts that were taken out and not the current amount that one's effectively paying capital gains tax on by the inclusion at the 50% of the asset value. So there's conflict with regards to the various dates that are required. There's a Saab date, there's SARS dates. Really, it's not necessary for all of that. One would either have just the Saab date to be included, or if SARS wants to have a slightly earlier date because they're worried about manipulation in the dying days of the proposals coming through, then SARS could have a 15 date and SARS could have a 16 date. But I wouldn't see the necessity for all of the dates. I don't really think one's going to achieve a lot of extra taxes. Yes, one can achieve a lot of extra funds leaving the country to pay all these banks for these valuations, but I don't think there's going to be any inherent benefit to the fiscus of all of those years as opposed to just one of those years for the valuation. There are also issues on the technical stuff where the South African companies diverted sales and those have effectively been donated to the foreign trust. Then the problem being is that was all done before March 2010, that South African companies made that donation before March 2010 to a foreign trust, and then it is excluded from the ambit of the Special Voluntary Disclosure Program, and that in itself does not make sense. So really for me, it's a simple solution that will resolve it, and if we do the simple solution, then I think this can all get wrapped up in the 6 months that are required. The same number that you give to Saab, use that as the basis for your Saab calculation. We don't need to know all the steps along the way from which company took the money to which donor donated those funds. I don't think all of that is necessary, because I don't believe we're going on a witch hunt, because we didn't go on a witch hunt after 2003. So why gather all that unnecessary information and cause the anxieties that might make people not do it? If you know what the value is at the reporting date, we pay a payment to Saab of 10% to leave the funds offshore. You pay a payment to SARS of 14%, which is based on that 50% using the corporate rate. And we make a payment of 14% to SARS to rectify all evils that happened with those funds along the way. And then we've got to our 24-25% that we believe people will live with. What is of concern is that we've had the opportunity to create the structural things necessary for people to regularize both in 2003 and in 2010. People didn't because of a mistrust in 2003, and people didn't in 2010 because the necessary structural environment was not there, because both things were not properly covered. If we want this to work, we need to cover both taxes properly. We need to ensure that there's a proper environment for people to do this. As a country, we need these funds now more than ever before. We can wait to after common reporting, and 5 years thereafter when SARS has deciphered all of the information that's been given to them, and 5 years thereafter when the court case has finally reached the tax courts. But why do we want to do that when we need the funds now for the development of this country and people want to regularize their affairs? If we don't use this opportunity, the funds will go deeper and deeper down, and yes, maybe they will be caught. But most of these funds have been there prior to the 2003 amnesty, and they weren't discovered, were not for the fact that the 2003 amnesty occurred, and they have not been discovered since then. So why do we want to risk it? Simplicity, all-inclusiveness, and we will benefit from this amnesty in a far greater manner than I think many people realize. I think that the 2003 amnesty was merely a tip of the iceberg and does not represent the substantial amount that is offshore. If we want this to benefit the country, to bring these funds home, to bring these funds within the domain of our control, to tax the fruit that will come therefrom for all time forth, now is the time to act decisively, and simplicity is required in that process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to explain before I throw it open to the members, the process, so that you understand that this is, if you like, the very initial phase of our engagement with the issue. So we've had briefings from Treasury, we hear you now. I should also draw members' attention to the fact that the PwC has made a submission, and this submission is for written, it's written, they didn't ask to appear before us. So what we do is we get our research team to organize your ideas and your proposals, and they offer us responses. The Treasury and SARS put every amendment you have onto a matrix. So every amendment that is proposed will be considered. We also, once the committee gets going today, recommend where appropriate to Treasury that they meet with the stakeholders, sometimes collectively, sometimes separately, to see if you can resolve the gaps between you. However, even if you arrive at agreement, this committee, as it has often, or sometimes, said, no, you and the stakeholders may agree, but this is Parliament. It's for us to decide. We like the gap to be narrowed. But the ultimate decisions are not made by your negotiations offline, so to speak, outside this committee. I also think we can't just include you. Where there's another stakeholder, like, for example, Rodisa, we would like some of the NGOs to be involved, in your case, the Department of Environment and so on. So then we also will have a workshop-type situation. I think the date has been set. We'll look at the program tomorrow morning, a draft of which was sent to you last week, and some changes may occur based on a discussion later today. We have set aside for a more intricate treatment. The committee members have been preoccupied with these tax issues since 2014. We find, well, at least the chair, let's start with me, I find some of these issues extremely complex, extremely technical. For what it's worth, I'm probably one of the most experienced chairs in the sense I first started chairing committees in 1997, ad hoc committee. I've chaired five committees, if I'm correct, and there are others who've chaired committee meetings here. I have never come across a set of issues that is so technically complex for parliamentarians to decide. So in 2014, we began to do some work, somebody who is an academic and myself, on how MPs treat tax bills, and I was quite taken aback. Even in the established democracies, where you have a big research team, actually, the nitty-gritty is not actually fully understood even by MPs, from what I can gather. But it's the policy issues that MPs have a say on. So that's our approach. Bearing in mind, this is a David Goliath situation, so to speak. And that's very sexist. Both David and Goliath are men. But you get the drift, right? So now, what we do is we say, basically, that in our reports regularly, that actually there's this imbalance, if you like. You know, you have these teams from SARS and National Treasury who are very experienced in this area. Then you yourselves are technical experts. We are not. So we're mindful of this imbalance. And we don't just like say, okay, fine, you know, we're gonna, if you all agree, we're going to agree. What we have already suggested to Treasury is that we consider for deferment some of the issues. Certainly if this committee does not understand the issues, the obligation is on the executive and SARS to make it simple, we will defer it. We're not voting on any clause that we don't understand. The obligation is not on us. We are not experts. We don't have years and years of degrees in these technical. I can't even add and subtract. I've got an E for mathematics for what it's worth. Right? Not that that's entirely relevant to understanding the issues, but hey, this is not my area. Okay? So what I'm saying is that I can assure, I'm once again repeating, I hope Momo is told this, that if we don't understand something, we're going to say, take it back, let's look at it next year. So I want to firstly compliment the presenters
for the most part been very simple. I really like, for my, you know, I'm a very simple person. Right? So this one, the charter, I really like the way the chartered accountants did it, but others are very simple as well. It's nicely done, each issue, you know, and so on. I can consult my 10-year-old stepson and ask him his advice, and he'll be able to follow what you say. So we've repeatedly told stakeholders, to Musani, remember, put things simply. Because whoever puts things simpler and clearer and is comprehensible to us is more likely to win the, let's say, what's the word, win the idea or the proposal. Having said that, I must thank you for the unusually simple way. Given the, you know, I must say, younger in front, last week it was quite complex, right, for a variety of reasons. But it's interesting, I said to them, when it comes to the public civil society stakeholders, we then begin to understand the issues better. Right. Having said that, can I suggest, colleagues, comrades, unless you disagree, that what we do is, because the GSA is a specific situation, that you deal with them first. Right? And when overlaps with the other stakeholders, we take that into account. But then we deal with the separate issues. But let's start with Regisa, or the environmental issues. Let's put it in the broad rubric. Okay, on those issues, what do members say? Mr. Lees, Sifiso.
Waiting for your go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the Redisa team. The stats are quite impressive in terms of taking the scrap tires out of the refuse tip. And what you're saying is that all this is going to come to an end unless, if this particular change is put in place. So there's no alternative funding. But please just clarify for me, that's just for 6 months. Are you saying that if it's delayed for 6 months, then the funding will be there again and everything will be fine? I'm not quite sure about that. Yeah. So that's the one bit of clarification. Does Redisa have any prognosis about when the industry will be self-sustaining, if ever? So in other words, would the additional, and I know, Hilton, you're arguing it's not a tax, it's a fee, but the man on the street just sees it as another charge and there's a tax. So is there no prospect of this kind of additional cost to the consumer ever being covered by the reuse? Tire rubber is ground up, it's used in tar, manufacture of roads, it's used in the manufacture of new tires, not just retreads. I come from the tire industry and I know the headache that scrap tires, just the ones coming out of the factory, have been for generations. Let alone the ones that are used and then scrapped. So, what is the future? If Redisa is indeed forced into some kind of liquidation, who are the shareholders and directors? Who would have to make these decisions? Who are the shareholders, essentially, is what I'm asking. Thank you.
Next, you know who you are. It's Sifiso, I think, yeah?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation from Redisa. Chair, let me just make this comment that except for the one set of presenters, the teams are not very transformed. That's very important for us when we come and make those types of presentations. But having said that, Chair, I think obviously there are other gaps that are there. But for me, I know that in most cases Treasury will be looking to get money into government coffers. That's very important. But I think I get persuaded about these other objectives of REDISA, especially around employment creation and the SMEs. I think that's very important. As we engage with REDISA, I think that's critical that we should be looking at these other objectives that the government is, and these are the biggest challenges that we have. The statement that I'm about to make it's very controversial coming from this side. Obviously, we are known as government as not the best employment creators. That's why sometimes I don't understand, Chair, when we are being criticized as ANC that we have failed to create jobs. Because I always take it that for us as government is to create an enabling environment, not to create jobs. The private sector must create jobs. So if jobs are not being created in South Africa, it's you, not us. But I think as a way of creating that enabling environment, Chair, I think Treasury should consider the pressing issues of the day and what would happen. I always say that from where I'm coming from as an economist, tech is good, but they are always having implications on economic growth and employment creation. So I think that balance, I haven't heard it coming from Treasury. That was my comment. But generally, Chair, I think a lot of arguments and presentations coming from REDISA are quite compelling. Thank you.
Who is making his maiden speech? So, Chandi, will you please not echo him?
No, Chair. I think you did not keep
records.
Old and doddery, not just I cannot add, I'm forgetting to. This useless committee secretary didn't intervene and say, but he did speak before.
No, right. Just a few questions. One, two, and I'll also go into the bill itself, but to first understand, is REDISA a private company? How are they constituted? Are they a profit-making entity? Are they an NGO? Who are they? You know, so it's very important. But secondly, how do they relate with civil society? There is a great deal of what they are saying, which has got to do with the creation of jobs. Quite commendable. I think, Chair, when we talk on the sidelines and in corridors, there's great passion from a generation I represent to preserve jobs. Because the South Africa of our dreams will become impossible without jobs. So, and I think that where we should be assisting each other is how do we allow for inventions or interventions that create jobs to sustain without creating a constraint to the economy. And I think maybe partly what Honorable Mazambani has raised, which I think is a point that is not yes. I'm honoring, you know, so which I think is quite important. But the second issue that Outen brings up is that the tire manufacturers can decide. So what is compulsory is for them to subscribe to a plan, not necessarily the other way around. But I think the point you seem to be missing there is for them to subscribe to an approved plan. Because I have understood this to be saying that if tire manufacturers were to subscribe, they must subscribe to an approved plan. And I think there was a logic here which they presented, which at least it's open-ended. It says, subscribe to a plan. So now a tire manufacturer can go. But the other serious issue, which I think that, and this is now on the Treasury side, you are saying that you are actually going to be charging people three times. You want them to pay a levy for a new tire, pay for a used tire, can pay when that tire is re-threaded. I'm not sure if our economy can be able to produce such kind of, when our people just cry with bus fare, that's a simple thing, money to go to work, and then he buys himself an Uno fire. You know, there used to be a car called Uno. And then now suddenly, you know, because whatever we do, these things are in a way pushed back to the consumer. So when you push it back to manufacturers, manufacturers push it back to the consumer. That's how it is. So I wanted to just say, maybe the Treasury will have a better understanding on that one. And perhaps, maybe if these guys could assist us understand better the notion of what is this extended producer responsibility. You know, the party I represent in its National General Council has started making reflection on the notion of a circular economy, reuse and all of that, to make sure that products do not necessarily meet their end of life. They could be used. They could be some what you call environmental resource management. So I'm trying to understand that, you know, what we saw as a revolutionary concept from the party I represent as the circular economy. How does this Redisa model fit into that? Because I get a sense that the concept gets thrown in there and left there without giving us a better insight to be able to deal with the issue. Now, I would have thought that in its proposed recommendation, Redisa would rather say that because you are reviewing this in 2017, if you were to look at a different kind of a scenario, why don't you address that when you do review and not only say deal with this in this 6 months? Because when we do that, we are taking a short-term view, and the creation of jobs in this country is not necessarily in some of the metros where the party I represent did not do quite well, jobs were quite an issue, you know. No, please, I'm just saying,
I like to rule that there shall be no reference to the August 3 elections for the next 40 years. It raises huge emotions here. Helps if you're a lawyer, you should help us. So I'm ruling there's no reference to it. Because nobody here agrees. All 52 million people have specific views about what the results mean. So 52 million views we can't manage here, please. Go ahead, please. You're ruled out of order. No reference. Can you expunge it from the record? Will be taking minutes?
No, but, Chair, I've spoken for 52 million people, man. At least I spoke. You know. So I think that is just the point. And if we are not clarified, I'm sure we can always come back to take a second bite. But really, the question is, where jobs are being created, we should be working towards making sure that such are nurtured. Of course, understanding what that does to the economy. You know, as a parting shot, we made the point last time that we should be looking at ways to increase our tax base, not necessarily to increase. You see, ultimately we'll increase, and one treasury official said to me, Pule, don't forget, you need money to run the state. But unfortunately, you can have money in the state coffers. If you don't have people who pay continuous tax, then what happens? The state collapses. I mean, our neighbors next door are a living example. We'll come back, Chair. Thanks.
Can you explain to us which neighbor you're referring to?
No.
You can do it in writing.
No, it could be neighbors from PRP, People's Republic of Palabura.
No, thank you, Chair. I think I'm aligning myself to what Honorable Pilemab is saying, but also just taking the issue, the 6 months issue that Honorable Mazambani also spoke to earlier on. I think, Chair, Treasury must assist us in this regard and really explain some of these things that the presenters, especially Redisa, has picked up. Because if you look at what Redisa is saying and what Treasury is introducing, there may be unintended consequences that comes along with the introduction of some of these taxes, and those that threaten job losses, as Comrade Pule has just said. But also, to some extent, it also says consumers will be digging deeper in their pockets while the economy is not doing well. And I think it's something that we should also look at. But the last issue, Chair, is on the recommendations. I'm not sure whether I understood Redisa well, whether I should read those recommendations together or separately. Because the first recommendation says, delete section, is it section 13 point something? And then the second recommendation starts by saying, alternatively, review, let's go into the review of 2017. So I'm not sure whether I must read them together or whatever, because I took the issue of unconstitutionality of the bill as something that is critical, that even if we come with other recommendations, but the fact that this is unconstitutional, it has to get an attention. So it must stand there as an issue so that we test the constitutionality or the unconstitutionality and then look at that thing. So like I'm saying, I'm not sure whether I read the recommendations correctly, whether I should read them together or separately. But I think I'll get clarity from that. Thank you very much.
Chair, thank you very much. You know, Chair, I just want to just put this into its correct context. One really can't run away from the fact that we do need an enabling policy environment to encourage the private capital to inject their money into the economy. However, Chair, there is something that I'm just a bit concerned about, and that is the lack of appreciation of the fact that, you know, the methodologies employed to avoid taxes have become so complex to a point where, and as they become complex, the reality is that you also have a widening gap between the rich and poor. And unless, as the state, you become decisive in your policy, you will end up at a later stage, if you are not decisive enough, you will end up really with more, because I've observed that everybody, when you are talking issues of tax, it's very easy for people to easily recommend that, why don't you look at that? But that is about your ordinary people largely. It's your ordinary people, it's those pensioners. You are not exempt from paying that. You go in the shop, you've got to be paying for that. And to me, I don't think that is sensitive enough to the quality of the economy that we have and the reality that we have. These extremes and this widening gap between the rich and poor. Now, this thing of us having to consider 6 months, I'm not sure if, because it's been proposed by a number of companies, I mean, SAICA, TKF, all of them, they're proposing more or less the same thing, that the time is short and that kind of thing. Now, I want to know, do they really, really understand or accept that the tax legislative regime has not caught up with the sophistication of tax avoidance strategy?
To remind you, we're looking at Rodisa's issues, but okay, can you finish that point?
Pardon?
We're looking specifically at Rodisa's issues, right?
Okay.
We'll come back to VDP later, but tie up on
okay.
the thing.
No,
I'll give
it's
you the
fine.
First.
I can
yeah.
stop there, Chair,
yeah, okay.
and you can come
no, no, you'll be the first.
I feel strongly about this particular one.
Yeah, no, we come to you first, no problem.
Okay,
let's
no
talk
problem.
On. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so that I can understand, more for Treasury's follow-up when they answer this. What Radice is saying is that the existing situation is there's a fee imposed in terms of the Environment Management Act or something, and that fee is primarily applied for the purpose of the environmental issues of science. The secondary benefit is obviously it creates jobs. The proposal going forward is that the same amount of money, bar the exemptions which you currently give for exporters and retreaders, which is a good point regardless, is going to go, this money is not going to go to them, goes into our state coffers, and then hopefully, but they don't know, and there's nobody knows at this stage, the minister will send the same R2 city to them, but they don't know this at this stage, or alternatively, less or more. But that's the real issue here. So the one goes, the moment they know exactly, the money goes into their recycling project, which has the benefit of the community as well as jobs, and the other is now going to go into an unknown budget allocation process, which if the minister needs money for something else, could rather go there, etc., and they don't have certainty, and that's really the issue. So if Treasury understands it the same way, and is there any way that we can give them certainty as to, and ourselves certainty, that if we put this into the theoretical black hole of the state office, that it will end up in recycling as well as in helping trade jobs.
Anybody else? Mr. Marvin wants to come in. And then Tandy.
Thanks, actually, when Honorable Makosi spoke, I just thought of something I forgot to ask. Whether Rodisa pays, collects and pays tax to... No, I wanted to understand the tax issue because they did not say much about this. You know, I'm just reminded when Makosi raises it that what is the value of annual VAT paid over to the receiver of revenue in the current dispensation? Because we are not getting that, you know. So that we know, is this being done or is it not being done? What are we dealing with?
Pandit? You're withdrawn. All right, fine. The researchers, anybody? Antonia, Dulasani?
Sir, I was going to come with quite broadly. The quite a lot of this on today, so I'll leave it for later.
Yeah. No. Right, good. Can I just, most of my issues are covered. What I wanted to ask though was, just alert you, we have Advocate Frank Jenkins here. Are you here? There he is. He will look at the constitutionality of the issue, right? And you will come back to us reasonably soon. But do you want to say something on that issue quickly?
Not now. Not until after everything. Thanks, Chair.
I hand over to the team, Helton's team.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We don't need long replies. If we want further representations from you, we'll give it to you in writing, but up to 5 minutes. Is that okay? Or slightly longer if you have to. Thank you.
We'll be as brief as we can. Just on the financial side, Rodisa is a non-profit company. It has 7 directors. I'm advised that 5 are female, 2 are male, 2 are white, and 5 are non-white, black directors. It's a non-profit company, therefore has no shareholders. However, the board retains all the responsibilities of a board of any company. And to address the issue of the concern over the 6 months, the simple reality is this board will be faced with the turning off of the taps of the financial support as from the 1st of October. Unless there is something to replace that income, the whole system will come to a grinding halt in a very short space of time. There are cash reserves, and I use the word in inverted commas, they're not long-term reserves, they will cover short-term cash flow requirements and operating costs, perhaps for a period of 4 to 6 months at best. The other problem, as I mentioned, was that you still have to plan for a winding down, which will cost a great deal of money and will be essentially wasted because the money that should be used to recycle tyres and set up these programs will be used to wind down the business. So those are not just possible consequences, those are real consequences. Mr. Cheadle mentioned, of course, that the other issue is you need to have long-term planning. If you're faced with having to rearrange your affairs every on short yearly budgets, you'll never know where you stand and you never can commit towards the programs which are important for the country. On the VAT issue, Redisa is being a non-profit company, isn't the income tax that currently pays 77 million rand per annum in VAT. So it's a substantial contributor to the fiscus from that point of view. The unique basis of the Redisa model is that it takes away the burden of the state to conduct these activities. And for that reason, the extended producer responsibility is such that it's the producers and the consumers who use the products consumed who bear the responsibility ultimately for the waste disposal. As regards the circular economy, this is a very important concept. The idea is, because of this model, it will become efficient and businesses will become self-sustaining, and over time, an entire industry with its employment opportunities will be created. It's a unique model in the world for that purpose, and that's why it has been acclaimed worldwide. Foreign governments have stated that this is a state-of-the-art, world-leading approach to this kind of problem. And they are very encouraged by the progress which Redisa has made and the success it has had. I think that's all on the economic side. I think Mr. Cheadle will talk to the other issues which you've raised. Thank you.
The first is a question of prognosis. Because this is so innovative and new, it is really quite difficult to predict, but certainly if you look at the long-term planning, the idea is to reduce the rate. And one of the ways in which they intend to do it is to establish a product testing institute to affect environmentally friendly tires. In other words, to go upstream and start setting standards for waste tires. And once that stream is established and as it becomes increasingly self-sustaining, the actual fee will drop. That is the intention of the plan. Then, in relation to the question of the compulsory nature of the fee, and I pointed out that in fact, if you look at the waste tire regulations, the waste tire regulations require a producer to either establish a plan or join one. Now, there is an approved plan, but nothing stops any producer from putting to the minister an approved plan of their own, as a single producer or as a group of producers. If one has a look at Section 28, one can see that a plan can be submitted by a single producer. And there may be a producer saying, listen, I will collect my waste tires myself. I do not have to belong there. Minister, approve my plan, and then I don't have to pay the fee because I have an approved plan, and I incur the cost of collecting my own tires myself. So it's important to understand that from a tax perspective. Then, insofar as the recommendation is concerned, you're quite right to point out that, in a sense, what we are recommending is the deletion of Section 13(2) read with Part 3 of Schedule 2. And we do that because we argue that it's unconstitutional for the reasons that we've set out. But alternatively, if one is not certain about this, and let me say to you that we have submitted submissions to the Davis Committee. The Davis Committee is specifically has the jurisdiction to look at taxation, and we've put those submissions to the Davis Committee. So if one doesn't trust our senior counsel, all right, then the question is, will the Davis Committee make the decision? and advise. So, again, that would allow for the second part or the alternative part of the recommendation would be defer this issue until the Davis Committee has made its a decision. And because of the implications it has in removing 6 months, 10% of an income for a 5-year plan, and its immediate effect on the ability for Rhodesia to continue, that it makes absolute sense to wait for a decision around is this a tax or a fee. You have Treasury saying it's a tax, you have us saying a fee, well, you've got a tax committee, let's let them decide, and that's what is then allow two things. If it indeed is a tax, in April you would have also aligned with it the alternative funding. And you'd sit here on the committee and you'd say, yes, there's alternative funding, it's been appropriated, here it is. And then we can talk about it. Then it seems to me the irrationality is removed. Until then, it's irrational. Let me just have a quick last look. I think that's everything. I hope I haven't left anything up.
Fine for now. If you want to make further representations on the questions that came to you, you're welcome to do so within 7 days. Now, I'd like to suggest, members, we think about the following. One is, I would urge that you stay, because Treasury will reply. What they normally do is they have a week or so, and then they prepare written replies. We, the norm in our committee is we send you the replies so that you can have a look at it, and then you can reply if you want. If necessary, so I don't think we will, unless it's absolutely, we can call you back. So what I'm suggesting is, members, just think about this. One is that we, remember, this is our initial feel for where you're at. We've heard Treasury, we hear you, we hear Treasury fleetingly again now. What I suggest is that we try to bridge the gap between Treasury, SARS, and yourself, and that, you know, that you meet reasonably soon. We can discuss it outside this committee meeting and see whether you can bridge the gap. But at that meeting, it might be useful to have an official of the Department of Environment there. The second thing to say is, as a committee, at some or other stage, the research team should set out what the issues are from Treasury side and SARS side, what the issues are from Rhodesia and whoever else has got to say on this matter. And we arrange, if necessary, to get the environmental committee, portfolio committee here. Because ultimately, we can listen to the executive organs and we can listen to the industry and civil society. But we as Parliament, the two committees, might have to look at this issue. That's the second thing. The third thing is, obviously, advocate Frank Jenkins will look at the constitutionality of the issue. Now, we want to alert stakeholders, and we've said this before, I have to repeat this. I know it's very boring for those of you who've been here since 2014, but there are different people who appear each time. You know, Elton, in particular to you, I mean, you're not just a lawyer, you're a political activist. You know, everybody who disagrees, almost everybody, with some clause or another, will say it's unconstitutional. And 80% of the time, it never proceeds even to the court. Now, you're an accomplished, astute lawyer. Well, I certainly take you more seriously, but still, we're not, like, blown by that, you know. I know the opposition parties will say, well, you keep losing in court and so on. That applies in some circumstances as valid. We could have foreseen those things. So we're not wholly, like, intimidated by that. We'll note that you feel the clause is unconstitutional in a report, Antonia, but we will decide whether the committee, having got advice, thinks it's unconstitutional. I find your other arguments, as Mr. Mabes says, more compelling than the argument that it's unconstitutional, but I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. So that's the process issue. What do committee members feel? I don't know what more we can do for now, but in respect of taking the matter forward, it's really complex, let me say. I must tell you, I hadn't thought about half the issues you raised. But here we are. Anybody want to say anything? It's interesting, one of our members is actually in the tire industry. That's really interesting. Right, Mr. Mabe. Why am I calling Mr. Mabe? Comrade Pule, yes.
Honorable. Honorable. No. No, that's fine. I wanted to
align myself with you, and I think it will be quite helpful that we take a joint portfolio committee meeting with the environmental affairs so that we can also give them an opportunity to brief us of where things are and all of that, and in the meantime have that aside engagement between the parties concerned, the Treasury and SARS, so that as we go into that other meeting we try and record progress. But like you are saying, Chair, I think it's very important that we make private players understand, even where they execute a public obligation, that as public representatives, what really grabs our attention is what is good for the people of South Africa. Now, you will find more friends if you spoke more about jobs. You know, the constitutionality part, of course, like the Chair is saying, is a different one. I mean, we contest for elections, and that's how we become a party that leads. And I think of great interest for us. And when we meet with environmental affairs, I'm sure that joint portfolio committee meeting should be trying to assess the socio-economic impact of some of these innovations that are underway.
Before we end with Rajisa,
so you want to say something quickly?
Yes, sure.
It was never our intention to intimidate anybody. There's one person that I know that would not be intimidated, is just yourself.
Yeah. No, I
didn't say you.
Okay.
The point simply is this, that we put a lot of emphasis on jobs. We put a lot of emphasis on small businesses. And you'll see that we've spent a lot of time in the submissions on that. The constitutionality is something that we need to bring to the committee. And I agree with you. If you have only one lawyer in a town, she's poor. Put two lawyers in the town and they're both rich. So, you know.
Just to say that the other thing is, when Treasury replies, can you tell us how much of what they said here they said to you before and why you said no? But the final thing is a major matter of considerable importance addressed to you, Alison Cheadle. I have been chairing local government committees for quite some years. It used to be called Constitutional Development and Provincial Affairs, at which time everybody says this clause is unconstitutional and that one's unconstitutional. And last week I answered on behalf of Advocate Jenkins at least three questions. I even added to what he said. You know the University of Cape Town, right? When you are deciding to confer PhD degrees in law, please, can you consider me? I've been dealing with these issues. Ask Advocate Jenkins. Right? I mean, I even respond after he has and add to it. But there you are. Some days between now and I turn 145. By the way, there's a woman I saw the other day who's believed largely to be 145 years old. For those of you who don't know. Up till now, the French woman, 122. When they asked her, how come you survived for so long? Well, they really survived. They would have said, how come you lived for so long? She said, patience. She said, patience. Right? Which country? Indonesia or something. Was it? Yeah. So when I'm 104 years old, I would like you to consider. She's a woman. It's a man. Oh, it's a man. I thought it's a man. I thought it's a woman. Sorry, yeah. So, okay, whoever, 145. So when I'm 104, consider me for a PhD. Right, over then to the next set of questions. Can I suggest we look at voluntary disclosure? Because it's specific, right? And then we deal with the other issues. Tracy will reply to Radisa in a moment. Makosi, who else wants to speak? You are a facilitator, Pinky. I already know that. Okay. So, who's next after Makosi? Who wants to speak? So, give me some sense of how much time I allocate to each person. Sipi, so you want to say something? On voluntary disclosure, is there only one question to be asked? In which case, you can speak for up to 10 minutes.
time. I don't like speaking for too long. Okay.
Yes, so you said.
Now, I was saying earlier on, you know, Che, it's important that when we raise these issues, we also make business so that we really appreciate them, and we also agree that there has to be a lot more that we do, whether by creating and enabling a policy environment for business to invest in our economy, because a lot of money is sitting in private hands. We cannot run away from that. However, Chair, I also wanted to say it's also very important that we, and in as much as we recognize that, we also need to recognize the fact that tax avoidance has become so complicated, especially the methodologies that are employed and so forth, to a point where indirectly, obviously I don't have empirical evidence to support my claim, but I do believe that the widening gap between rich and poor can also play in that space, can be explained with those factors as well, where the rich are no longer, they have these ways of avoiding paying taxes, and we need these taxes. And I am saying, have you considered, and I'm merely talking to SECA and PKS in particular, because they seem to have issues with the 6 months period that we are giving. I understand that maybe to you it may not seem enough, but the reality is that if as the government each time we come up with a legislation, then we say 6 months, then we change it to say 2 years or 24 months or whatever, we are also inadvertently making the people who are implicated in the process, whom we want to come closer, to think that there will be another extension in future. And I am saying, if you consider that it is important for us to catch up with these tax avoidance methodologies, and extending the time may not necessarily be in our favor. If I say in our favor, I'm not talking about just us as elected officials, because I know the common thing is that there is money that is being done, corruption, blah, blah, blah. We hate corruption. But we are saying the reality is that we need to reduce the gap between the rich and poor. And the reality is that the digital global economy is more in favor of the rich, because they have a way, I mean, capital is very mobile nowadays. It's just as a touch of a button, then it's gone, and you know, it's so easy to do business and all that. Can you also consider those factors when you are putting forward your submissions? Because we do not want to create a situation where we are guilty of indecision. Because when you keep on changing deadlines, you end up becoming like somebody who's not decisive. You don't know what you want, you know? And hence, you keep on making reference to the old cases. You remember last time you guys came up with this and you had to change because, you know, there was no uptake and that kind of thing. Shouldn't we get to a time when we are becoming definite and say 6 months, and we just, so that we are sending a strong message that we are not going to be so open and negotiable in these processes, because that could disempower us from, you know, recovering this money. We must remember, we are also encouraging, and we had engaged with National Treasury on these issues, because we are encouraging, you know, those sectors that may be implicated in this to come forward. And the only way they can come forward is if you are definite about the time. If you are going to change it, it has enormous implications. It can make people just say, well, I'm just going to sit with this. And then when it's close by, then they say, well, I'm going to change. Now, I just want us to just remember that and probably to respond to us. How do we deal with that? Think about us and on our side as the legislative arm of government, and we need to make sure that we create an enabling environment, and we need to balance these key factors that are cited. How do you think we should deal with that so that we are not seen as being indecisive? Because we don't want to create that impression to you. In your recommendations, can you come up with something that is saying, addressing our concern as well? We've heard your concern, we understand you, but we want you to also understand our concern as people who must be passing this legislation. Thank you.
Other issues on Sifiso?
Just one comment from me. I'm not very sure I'm convinced about why is it difficult to raise assets over 5 years. The argument which has been presented is not very persuasive. Perhaps there's something I'm missing there. 5 years is quite a short period in business, and you are required in many jurisdictions, even here, to keep the records for 5 years. But I'm sure that we take this from an international norm.
Anybody else? Mr. Topham? Sorry? What? What about Saika? Yes, we're asking on voluntary disclosure, whoever raised the issue and whoever didn't raise the issue, then we will look at the remaining issues. So if it's on voluntary disclosure, Mr. Topham?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you look at the various presentations in PwC, they basically all have the same themes, 95% identical issues, which is cool. I think the issue of the rate, that's not a big one, because no matter what the rate is, some people think it's too much. But the common theme, and I hear what they're saying, is that the time to get those old records is an issue. I know for certain that specifically when people were hiding money from the National Party, there was no documentation kept, etc. And people don't have the documentation. That is an issue. So I like the idea of making it a little bit more simpler on a date or something like that, even if the rate is higher. And specifically then from SARS's response later is, you know, can we simplify the date processes? And then if the 6 months is not an issue, because collection of documentation won't be as important, because the whole nature of people that have set up complicated offshore structures is that the paper trail doesn't exist, and people can't remember 10 years ago. In fact, I can't remember a year ago. So, and some of these, and it would be interesting on another side to see an estimation of when these monies flew out the country. You know, I think majority of the money that came in the first one was probably pre-94 money, etc. So, and then also we must also bear in mind there's not all necessary tax evasion. You know, back then, some of the things that was done was tax planning, but it was a breach of the exchange control. It's not that it makes much difference, but you know, not all money because it's offshore is necessary. The breach of the tax act could have been the exchange control and the hobby of getting money out of the part of that government at the time.
Anything else?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Good morning or good afternoon, Chair and all members and colleagues. Just on a quick process issue, I have already spoken to Mr. Makumba earlier on, so we're definitely trying to expand the tech support team. And let me introduce my colleague as well. We have a new colleague. Did you miss? Okay, all right, thank you so much. On VDP, just a quick point. The point that we raised in April was that the lessons and experience of the previous CDP needs to be taken into account. I think that's interesting. And also cost-benefit analysis needs to be taken into account. So as I said, I think one point by site on safe harbor. There was a paper on, there was an article on in 2014 Tax Journal there about the safe harbor on transfer pricing. It's quite interesting to try to compare the benefits and the disadvantage of safe harbor, and it was quite strong on that it could be some the benefits, the disadvantage outweighs the benefits of bringing the safe harbor there. So I just want to find out from you how practical would bring safe harbor in this scenario make this issue quite better. Thanks, Jim.
To say very quickly, I think the committee, most of us at least, understand there's a complex set of balances and trade-offs here. Right? But many of us will also argue, you know, it's true, if you make it easier, less onerous, then the people who are affected will come forward, you know, in greater numbers. But the question I also wanted to raise, and it's the treasury to ultimately answer, is in any case, we're going to get this automatic exchange of information on the 1st of September. I hear what the chartered accountants say. Yeah, you can go through that process. It will take you 5 years before anything gets going, another 5 years in the courts. But there is, if you like, these trade-offs. But looming over the set of trade-offs is the 1st of September 2017. Now, I hear the passion sometimes with which people make representations to this committee. But the truth of the matter is, in the first and last instance, what these people have done is wrong. Morally wrong in most cases, not all. And legally wrong in many cases, if not most. So, you know, we can be sympathetic. We can be driven solely by finding the right balances. But also, you know, this is morally wrong, what they've done. And in other areas where you commit offenses against the law, you don't have necessarily this degree of latitude given to you to get away. And we will obviously be pragmatic, but I think it's reasonable for some of us to say that's just wrong, what is going on. And it shouldn't happen again. And we need to actually communicate that we think it's wrong. However, that will, we're not going to be driven by a moral consideration solely. We have to be pragmatic. We will be pragmatic. But please don't forget that what people have done here in the very first instance is wrong. That is all I want to say for now. I'm very keen to hear Treasury. We have done some work, unlike on some of the other stuff, like Regisa and so on voluntary disclosure. The committee has done a bit of work. We have got, say, two briefings at least, one with the joint one with the NCOP committee. So I'm much more practical, I'm much more familiar with the issues here. But I'm not going to say anything here. I don't have anything useful to say. So I'll hand over then to the people who deal with GDP to quickly, up to 3 minutes each, to respond. Anybody wants to respond on GDP from the stakeholder side? Thank you.
Chair, on the issue of the six-month rule, I agree that it would be best that the matter is resolved within a short period of time. And I think in one of my discussions with SARS, I threw away the line of 6 months. If the issue was solely the valuation at the effective date and one applies whatever percentages are to that valuation. I think the issue is that when one combines the number of years valuations that are being requested together with the detailed information on source of funds and from which companies they came from, the issue of 6 months becomes too short. I think if we get to simplicity, then 6 months is where we ought to be. We've also lost a lot of time between February and now by not having an exemption from FICA and IRBA. So we've lost those 4 months in not being able to begin a process of gathering information and promoting the foreign exchange GDP because of the fear of what it is going to do to one's clients. And that, I think, also needs to be taken into account. Five-year documentation might be a standard and a norm, but we are dealing with what the Chair quite correctly regards as being illegal activities. And there aren't documentations in detail of those illegal activities by their very nature and for that very nature. So the ability to say, well, the standard and norm is a five-year retention, these documents would not have been retained as a consequence of what was involved therein. If one looks at a cost-benefit, and I think that's really where one's got to go to, one's got to make a decision on a cost benefit or tracking of expediting the process of electricity. And you know, we are here because we've been approached by a UK solicitor who's representing various clients. We don't know which South African clients are involved, but we're talking in the region of 3 to 5 billion rands worth of assets that are being referred through to a Durban firm. In my opinion, the amount of money that is outside is far in excess of what was dealt with in terms of the first amnesty. And the reality is, 13 years after that first amnesty, that significant amount of money still remains outside of this country because of the lack of the ability to recover those funds. To place every whim on common reporting standards, when in fact there are the abilities to put many thresholds in place of companies and structures to eliminate the benefits of common reporting, whilst there is the ability to put these funds in the names of nominees who might be resident in one of these countries and therefore not have to report in terms of common reporting, I think is putting the country at far greater risk than saying the time has come to make this simple, let people come forward and regularize. Because otherwise, somebody from this committee is going to need to look at Mr. and Mrs. Average South African in the face, either this October or next February, and say, because we were not bold enough, VAT is going up 3%, because we need the money. And I don't think that the country would look kindly upon those who have the ability to make a bold stand, to say, let's regularize all that is out there. Let's go forward with the income that's going to come from there when one doesn't have that ability now. To catch those people is not going to be easy. And to rest on it on common reporting in 10 years' time when the process is done, I think is too great a risk for this country to take. Thank you.
Can I just respond on behalf of Psyche to some of the points that were raised? I think we take the exact same view that tax evasion is totally wrong. What we're talking about here in most cases would have been tax evasion rather than having proper structures outside South Africa. I mean, that's what the purpose of the special VDP is. I think with the common reporting standards coming in September 2017, I would anticipate this to be the last amnesty that will be available. I doubt very much whether there's going to be a future one, so I don't think that it's going to be seen as being indecisive in some way if the 6-month period was extended to 12 months. And I think that the issue really is that taxpayers simply are not able to comply with the 6-month period. It's too short. Just bearing in mind, and also just to come back to the other point that was raised, it's not simply a question, in many cases, of simply having the last 5 years bank statements, etc. The issue really is, if you're talking about a house, or you're talking about unquoted shares, you've got to get 6 different valuations, which seems to be overkill to us. You've got to get a valuation 28th of February 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, and February 2016 for the exchange control special VDP. So that's really the issue. It's very cumbersome, very time consuming, and of course costly, which I think the cost would be seen to be part of the overall penalty that one would have to pay. We would agree that by having the special VDP, I think it does definitely expedite people coming forward. It enables them to come forward, and I think ultimately we're going to collect more revenue. I think if the special VDP is not in place, many of those taxpayers are simply going to take their chances with the common reporting standards, and ultimately the fiscus is not going to collect as much as it would have done otherwise. So we as FICA would support the special VDP.
Yes, sir. This is very soon to come back. We're running out of time. We still have other issues as well. But fine, go ahead and then I'll get Tandy to respond.
Thank you, Chair. I'll keep it very short. I'm from Sahid. Just to explain my background, I look after other tax practitioners. I'm a specialist tax practitioner helping with cross-border issues. So on the issue of the deadline and the 6 months period, we fully agree that we need decisiveness. And it's interesting that part of the fact that the 6 months is too short is because of SARS and National Treasury having failed to give us rules on Section 31. So up till now, we can't help the people who took money illegitimately out because we don't have the safe harbor of FICA Act. What we're doing are helping people to say, did you correctly or incorrectly report your foreign trust's income in terms of Section 31 on the interest-free loan? And that's the very same topic you dealt with last week in 7C on the local trusts. Okay. So the fact that we have this problem is an undecisiveness from government agents. Secondly, the nature of the information, it's not just 5 years. In that 5 years, we have to calculate what amount of assets comes from undisclosed income, which means I must track it back to year dot. So I only report 5 years, but my collection and tracking goes far back because I must be able to give a sworn affidavit what part is income and what part is capital. Okay. And I have to advise my client on that, so I'm at risk. Then on the 6 months and why we want a year, we have to look at what's happening in the world. And SARS tends to exclude automatic exchange of information or people that was disclosed because of that international agreement, ITAs. The rest of the world, and the UK as fresh as yesterday, extended their period until September 2018, which is the second cycle of the common reporting. Okay, so we are lacking the world in that sense, because there is some ITA information, mainly via FATCA, an American side, and the stolen information coming through the IRS. But the true information will only be in South Africa by September 2018. So we do have time. So let's rather make it a bit longer and ease the burden of research. So I'm asking for both. I'm greedy, I know. Then on the five-year banking side, just one of the questions was, we don't understand why it's so difficult to get the information. We must look at what happened in the world. Most South Africans, and this is people who were totally legitimate exchange control side, took their money across, created the trust, or kept it in their personal name. They favored banks like HSBC, UBS, and I pronounce it maybe wrong, Bank Leumi in Israel. Those banks collapsed or closed down certain divisions because of what an American government did to them. And they merely wrote letters to South Africans. Your account is frozen, it's closed, transfer to a new bank account. I am still struggling to date with one client where I had sit with a check made out to Mrs. H and then their surname, Mr. and Mrs. H in their surname. Because in that country there's a joint account, it's legal. In our country it's not. To get that Swiss bank to understand, please give me separate checks, is very difficult. So we also have a banking system that's disjointed with the rest of the world, and we have to overcome that. In closing those bank accounts, the relationship with a UBS or an HSBC has totally terminated. Now we expect them to give us information going back 25 years on a client they've already, excuse the pun, gave the middle finger to. They are charging us 5,000 Swiss francs to reopen that information because they're saying we're doing it for close to 122 countries at this moment. Okay, so it's the fact of the history and the reluctance of the parties on the outside. And to allow me this, sometimes, and I think the elephant in the room is that we feel that maybe it's a white crime. For the record, in 2003, I did 1,021 applications. 675 of those were ANC and PAC members, black. It is known as public record that I was on a way meeting to Hazel Crane, and I filed nearly 450 returns she never signed. So again, what the previous speaker earlier asked, take away who was the facilitator. It came out because of a court case. But I don't think she wanted everybody to know that she helped the cadres to take money out, or they helped her. I don't know which way it's around. The issue of money offshore is no longer a white privilege. There's a lot of people who came back, But they feared the changes as much as I, as a white man, may have. They now have trust in the government. They want to clear it up. Let's allow that, because there's a lot of money out there that families left there and they now want to bring back, because some of the older family members couldn't come back. Some of the siblings feel they are not South African. They became English. They became Zambian. And that speaks to why we want on the trust, the facility that we can do it proportionally. Because there's trust out there where some members are in South Africa and some members are staying in Australia. So we have to get very practical. And that's why I like the PKF approach. Whoever holds the money, let them pay their percentage. And then the last thing on the comment that was made earlier about the safe harbor. Also, not a safe harbor as for tax. You know, we say there's a safe harbor where you pay less tax or not. Ours is, we just want this, the facilitator and the advisor in the current process to be exempted. Because I know what happened in 2003 and I know what happened in 2010. It took me 4 months to convince the facilitator sitting in London, help me get the information. Because you sit with a family member that comes to us and say, I want to disclose, but I'm not the trustee, and I'm not a vested beneficiary. I have no legal right. Until I can get that trustee to pass a minute to allow me to do it, I can't do anything. So we need time, not just the time of compliance. We are going the next phase after this law comes out, and hopefully we get the FICA exemption and the Yoruba one that PKF asked. It's to now sit for hours on a telephone speaking to a trust administrator in the Channel Islands, saying to him why it is good to play the game. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then, Makosi, can I alert you to time constraints, right? So, remember, we're meeting next week, Wednesday, with Treasury's formal response. You are invited to attend, and members can pick up on some of these things there. Over to you, Tandi and Makosi.
Chair, are you allowing me to speak on overall, or... Chair, I was not intending to speak on policy matters today. I only wanted to ask questions. But listening to the presenters, how they respond, it forces me to look at policy matters. You see, when we're looking at the voluntary disclosure program, the intention is not to look at race. It's not a race issue, whether you are white or black, or we're looking at whether was there a moral justification for profit shifting. Right. We look at why does South Africans feel that they should not participate in our tax system. So it's not a race issue. Second, whether the process is going to be cumbersome, it's a matter that National Treasury must respond to. We'll look at that. We'll apply our mind on those issues. So here we find a situation where the presenters say to us, for argument's sake, exchange control VDP process should be a permanent process. I mean, really. How can a voluntary disclosure process that relates to exchange control be a permanent process? It means people are basically saying that we're not going to disclose unless you ask us to volunteer to disclose. We'll continuously look at issues of exchange control with a different eye altogether. So it puts us in the same basket where profit will be shifted, and then we'll have to look at the exchange controls. And it addresses the issues of, is it morally correct to always do this? It's got nothing to do with prior 1994 or any other matters that happened before. It's the obligation of South African citizens to pay tax in their own country of origin. Whether it's capital gains tax or any VAT, it's a basic norm. So we don't want to go there. Now here's my question, Chair. I want to know why do we believe that we need to have a high level application and not a normal application to the process, so that we can clearly understand what will be the challenges if you don't his, I'm taking into consideration the 6 months period. I'll apply my mind on that one. Secondly, the common reporting standard is not a process that just came by. It's through the hard work of countries that believe that countries like Panama were not doing us any favor with continuously not participating in the international. The responsibility of individual companies and individuals to disclose to that reporting standard. I've listened to the issues of being it cumbersome to provide information. I need more clarity what will make it cumbersome. And so that if it's capacity issue, we know whether it's capacity issues, both within SAB and National Treasury. If SAB and National Treasury came to a conclusion that this legislation should be tabled as is, it therefore suggests that they believe, because I don't believe that stakeholder must speak on behalf of the South African Reserve Bank in relation to the collection time, based on the previous steps that they were able to do it within a period of 3 years. It should be based on what they think that they can do in the current conjunction. So SAP will speak for itself in relation to collection, and they must be able to tell us how they will do. And I want us to get clarity on this unconstitutional clause that needs to be deleted, that section 32 that has been related to even by a reducer, so that Mr. Jenkins is here. I would like it to also, when we go and consider it, we hear his views in relation to that. It has been very clear. So that when we go and apply our minds, we know, even National Treasury has their own legal experts to explain to us. Now, the other issue, Chair, there's a request that the that auditors should be excluded from this process. I want to know why. You know, audit firms, when they are given a task, they do it to the best, to the interest of their client in most cases, not necessarily doing what is standard in relation to the information they must provide. So once you say they must be excluded, then it raises the flag, an interesting issue. So we'll have to understand why in this context they should be taken into account. We'll consider the issue of the small groups that might be adversely affected. When we engage, I think we'll look at that. But just look at these obligations of auditors and why they shouldn't be subjected to the same standard. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I'm partially covered by Thandi. The issues around black, the number of black people who are affected by this, neither here nor there, because if you go into values, you might actually find that probably that 600 and something odd is only equivalent to one taxpayer. You know, so I'm saying we must not be misled by this racial tones or whatever about this. But Chair, I wanted to find out from Treasury if they can assist us. Was there any special dispensation for exile retainees in terms of their, you know, them having to disclose what sort of assets probably they you know, they accumulated whilst they were outside the country. I just want to find that out, because there's something that just occurs in my mind. If somebody can assist me, please. Maybe Younger?
I'd like to suggest there's no need for this. Oh, you want to say something?
Two issues that I wanted to raise, if you allow me. Chair, I'm interested to know why the facilitators should not be disclosed. Because let me tell you something. In many instances, the issue of profit shifting is facilitated by the facilitators, not the investors themselves. So somebody who may be having money offshore might have not been aware of racism before. So it's the facilitators who have the know-how, the expertise. And once you don't know their operations, it's something else. And also, we will consider the issue of trust. Maybe we have not paid much attention to it. Maybe we should look at how this trust operates and how those individuals, without necessarily suggesting that because the trust has not been given the same dispensation, therefore we should not look into other matters. Thank you.
Even from the committee, right? We've got 17 minutes left. A lot of the issues were pointing to how members feel, rather more than precise questions to the stakeholders. The one option is for us to get Treasury to respond to the issues briefly and fleetingly, and that we carry over these hearings to next Wednesday. In any case, Treasury will come with their formal replies. Now, I know some of you have flown in from Swanee and Joburg and wherever. In one case, Etegwini, Durban, right? You came. Now, you know, you've got Cape Town contacts, and or you can fly up again if you have to. Or in some other form, we can communicate to you what came out of next Wednesday's meeting. Now, the norm is the committee secretary sends you the responses, the written responses from Treasury and SARS. And then we also have, as I told you, a matrix. All your concrete amendments are included in the matrix. And we allow you to speak in this committee beyond just a formal public hearing. You will read in the newspapers that we are fast-tracking bills and all that. That's Alice in Wonderland nonsense. I'd really like to use the word I would. You know, there's a person from a party last week. Let me give you how bizarre this is. We are sitting in G26. This person stands up in the House, and then the powers that be contact me and ask if it's true, and saying, you know, we're not having enough public participation and so on. I ask the committee secretary, sitting simultaneously with us are the stakeholders, while we're being told there's not enough public participation. Advocate, whatever you are, you should one day when you've got nothing else to do, I will send you something and show you how the committee runs. We have public hearings by including in the committee the stakeholders, and they say, well, there's no public participation, that's enough for the bill. So I have to waste my time and get him, draft a letter, send it and so on. These are actually lies. So you might read all those things, but we do not believe we should process these complex tax bills in particular without the fullest consultation. But end of the day, as we say to you, we are the elected public representatives. And we have said to you, form your own, in your case, PKF or KPF party, stand for elections in 2019. Right? So we hear you, we consult with you, we insist they consult with you, we ask them for replies. Ultimately, though, we decide. That's the way democracy works, my friends. So I don't know whether you want to reply. Now, can the committee say to me what you want me to do? If you want to extend the sitting, we need about 5 minutes, if Mr. Leith cooperates, 5 minutes, because we can defer the program for tomorrow, but just agree on the broad framework. For the rest, so if you take 5 minutes off, we've got 10 minutes left. There are other issues now, not fair to the other stakeholders who came here from wherever they did. We've looked at the environmental stroke recycling issues. We've looked at voluntary disclosure. What about the other issues? We have to look at that too. Now, Tandi has some questions around that. So what I'm saying is, guide me, what do you want? One option now is, let's start with this. Are members able to stay beyond 1 o'clock? Let's start with the easiest thing. How many can stay beyond 1 o'clock? One of you. Sorry. No, don't say if you can't. Who can stay beyond 1? I know because people have... You've got a committee meeting, I know that, of course, yes. Who can stay beyond 1 o'clock? None of us, right? Now... then I've set out a program for a process for you. Anybody have a problem with that? No. Yeah.
I thought you said that while we agree on the process we are setting, allow the Treasury just in briefly.
Okay, we agree. Now, Tandi first, on issues apart from environmental, apart from voluntary disclosure, you wanted to ask Saika some questions. Oh, then, okay, on any member got any question, including you, Dumasani, and whoever was in the research team, about issues apart from these two? No, you do.
I had a point that I wanted to say. I think it's related to General G about the fact that when the proposals were made, the focus of the GDP was at a certain level. So I want to ask the industry and Treasury whether this is probably a policy issue, Chair, but I'm just going to put out there whether the current tax instruments, are they sufficient to get us where we focused our revenue to be? Are they sufficient enough? And that's the first point. I think it's quite good to get a view of the SAICA and other audit firms there. The other point is just on the fiscal threat. Are the beneficiaries able to enjoy the benefits that was put out there? So, thanks.
The questions put to the stakeholders be sent to you by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Let's expand it. Let's make it noon tomorrow. Anybody in the committee or any of the researchers have got questions, can you send it to me? And I will direct them without doubt. Please, I'm urging the DA. You can't take over the role of the chair, right? You can't decide you writing and so on. Do that outside the system, but it's not done by the committee. The only thing you will get, you're free to engage with parties outside. But as far as the committee goes, unless it's on the letterhead sanctioned by the committee secretary or me, it's not legitimate. No, nothing stops people from writing on their party letterhead. That's separate. As far as the committee goes, there's a committee secretary and a committee chair. I do not interfere with questions. So, members, I'm giving you up till noon tomorrow to submit questions in writing, and you will get it by 5 p.m. tomorrow. Right? We're agreeing on that. Then, over to Treasury, you've got 5 minutes. Can you respond to the persistent thematic issues that emerged?
Okay.
Let's start with the RDSA issues and the voluntary disclosure.
Okay. Chair, I'll respond on RDSA. On VDP, I'll respond on policy issue, and SARS will respond on application, capacity, and administrative issues on SDGP. On the RDSA issue, we have had discussions with DIA before the 2015 budget on the issue versus the tax and the fee. So, because that discussion led to the budget proposal in 2016. So, there were discussions almost a year with DIA. And even now, we are discussing with DIA on the impact of the proposal. We had a meeting with DIA last week. We're going to have another meeting with DIA next week. So, the impact and the consequences, we are discussing them with DIA. But the issue of constitutionality, we have to look at it. And then coming to the issue of SVDP, this SVDP was meant for non-compliant taxpayers to come forward before the new global standards come into effect. At Treasury, we had to strike a balance between incentivizing non-compliant taxpayers versus those who were compliant, who were paying their taxes, paying interest if they pay tax late, and were hit with penalties. And we want to bring it to the committee that this is the third draft bill. We had the draft bill that was published on the budget day, 24 April. We had the draft bill that was published on 12 April. This draft bill was published on 20 July. This is the third one. We've taken into account all the comments. We had a meeting on the 10th of June. We've taken into account all the comments of the taxpayers trying to simplify the matter. So this is the third bill that we are publishing today. So SARS will respond on the administrative and capacity.
Thank you, Nyanga. Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of brief points. So the point that's being made that you have to go back into 20, 30 years ago and do splits on capital versus in revenue income puzzle me immensely, because the model has changed from one where we went back to the initial income that wasn't declared to one where you look at the assets that are held. Now, we can certainly debate whether you need to look back for 5 years or need to look back for 2 years or 1 year, but the fact of the matter is you're now looking to the assets, not to the original income. There is still obviously a linkage, because if you are now given a voluntary disclosure relief, it has to relate to something, and it needs to relate back to the original income, because that is what was not originally taxed.
when we talk to issues like the FIC and the Uber exemptions, and I'm going to put those in inverted commas because the FATF has issued guidance that you should not be granting exemptions with respect to voluntary disclosure programs, and what is currently in progress from those two institutions is guidance on how to approach it, which will get, I believe, the professional advisors pretty much where they need to be, but in a slightly different framework, because the world has moved on since 2003 and 2006. When we speak to things like we'll drive people further underground, the use of nominees around the CRS and so forth, I think I've made the point before this committee that those are clearly things that could happen, but it's getting much more difficult. And I think this committee's own experience in amending the FIC Act on beneficial ownership speaks to precisely that kind of topic. We have moved beyond just looking at the person who opened the account and starting to look beyond that person. That is not something that is unique to South Africa. That is something the rest of the world has begun, has moved on. We're in fact catching up. And I can only imagine that that kind of movement will continue into the future. So, just to conclude, I think it's in everyone's benefit to have as simple a system as possible. But having said that, it still needs to be fit for purpose. It still needs to be something that strikes the balance between, as Younger points out, the taxpayers who have complied in the past and the legitimate expectation that the people who didn't pay in the past at least will make a substantial contribution and will pay into the future. And as the Chair, you have correctly pointed out, that's a balance that needs to be struck. And obviously you've now heard from industry that feels we need to be more generous. I certainly heard in the last set of discussions with this committee members feeling we needed to be less generous, and somewhere we need to strike that balance. Thank you.
Having said that, here it is. We will, can I suggest, Ghost, that by, it's a lot of work, I know, but by Monday, 5 p.m, you give your written responses. He will send it out to everybody, the members of parliament, whoever else, and the stakeholders. On Wednesday, what will happen, Pule and Tandi, is we'll do the normal thing. We get a reply from Treasury, we engage with Treasury, you will have a chance to reply to Treasury, and then Treasury will reply to you, and then we bring it to a closure, right? And then where and as necessary, we will bring you back. Where and necessary, you will write to us and say, hey guys, you know what, this is not fair. You can monitor these things. Sometimes it appears on 408 channel, that's not Ellen's response, or sometimes you see, I don't know where it appears there, right? If you've got the time or energy, if you don't have a life, you can look at that. So having said that, thank you very much. Let's then move on to our own internal issues. You don't have to stay for this. It's going to be a huge fight here. You've got better things to do in life. Unnecessary fight. Okay, let's go on to the program. Just remind members, right, if I can have everybody's attention, because we need a decision on this. Yeah, everybody is right. So basically, look, the way the program works here, if you recall, from 2014 we had a strategic fat plan, if you like, for the whole year, and within which we locate our program. Then the fat plan never really worked because people would, every person who felt he or she wanted to put an issue on the agenda, but why do the majority decide? We put it on. So the fat plan was here, and the program was there. So for 2016, no fat plan from the chair, because the chair spends a lot of hours doing a thing, well, not hours, but minutes, and nobody really paid much attention. So hey, I got a life. So we dropped the fat plan for the year. Now, here we are. We have a program. The way it works is there's a management committee. I've checked with other chairs, as I told you. Most of them don't function with a multi-party system. Some only with the chair, some with the chair and the whip. In our case, we've included one DA, one EFF, the whip, and me. But then what happens is often it's difficult to meet. And often we meet so often that we can shape a program. So the program for the quarter of a year is shaped through some management committee system, even if it's just me sitting there with Alan and the research team. Now, when you make changes within it, or changes here and there, usually I make them, and then I bring them to the committee and say, hey, we've swapped things around. Only on one occasion was there a big problem or they completely misunderstood. So when there's a request from parties, the UGM is not here, it's not my decision. It's not my decision, unless it's a minor technical thing. It's a committee's decision. The program is not shaped by me. I mean, I just do the preparatory work. So when members request, they must actually understand that they can request, but they make it like it's my individual decision. Please, when they write the endless media statement, get it right. You can request via the committee secretly to me to put it before the committee. I don't run the show like it's my spada shop, yeah? Right. So, secondly, I got a request from Mr. Lees on Friday. He phoned me to say he's worried about SAS. I said, yeah, so what? All of us are worried. And he went on and I said, look, what I want to talk to you about, just write. It's a procedural thing. He wrote to Alan to ask for a meeting. Of course, it was in Radio Mongolia and all before, you know, he did say he's going to do it. But usually what one party in particular does is they release a letter written to a chair, to the media, and a few hours later they remember that they have to send it to the committee secretary. In Mr. Lisa's case, he just phoned me on Friday, but I didn't know what there was to talk about. So then on Sunday appeared an advert in, I think, the Sunday papers, which I hadn't seen, where SAA is now asking for 16 billion rands from institutions in the private sphere. Alright. Sorry? What? 16 billion, what did I say? No, sorry, I meant billion. Really? Right. So then, Mr. Lees called for a meeting. Well, of course, I think presumably into the media first. I only heard about it at about 4 o'clock. 3 o'clock or something, I can't recall. There was some misunderstanding. I explained the program that Alan sent to you was the one that I agreed to after. What he tried to do in this program, nothing sinister, no conspiracy. We said, let's lump all the tax bills together if we can. That is all. Poor Alan, when he, you know, you're on the constituency road and he tells you he's going to advertise for a hearing. Hell, man. Do you think I'm going to stop the car and check the date? And I said, look, do it in this 2 weeks. Not realizing there's two sets of bills. We wanted to lump all of it today. So if I had worked it all out, I would have said, let's do all the tax bills from 10 o'clock to 5 o'clock like today and got it over with, right? So he's got two separate hearings. And we realized we can't change that. So we then consulted with Momo. Momo and Cindy and Ghost don't decide for us. We ask them, listen guys, how can we save money? How can we save your time? So you come here at one go. And then Momo gives some ideas. So we juggle that around. That's the draft you've got. Now we've got a recommendation from this thing. So I contacted Jonas on Sunday night. I spoke to Cindy. I couldn't get hold of her. And then Ghost. And finally I got the minister. Interesting that the minister, the deputy minister who deals with SAA and the DG were at the same meeting. So they said to me that the minister, what I said to Mr. Lee, to expect SAA to come on Wednesday, it's not going to be workable if Friday is the option, if the majority agrees. Sorry? Tomorrow. It's not reasonable. We also have to prepare them and tell them these are the 5 or 6 questions you guys want to ask them, 1, 2. Firstly, I'll come to the committee with a proposal. That the committee decides whether you want to call SAA, and if so, my suggestion would be it'd be Friday next week. Friday this week, sorry, on the 2nd. We'll have to sit here, colleagues, to remind you, comrades, Friday is the sitting. Now, then I told the minister, explain to me he's at the G20 on Friday. Then the DM is in Zimbabwe on Thursday and Friday. The DG is in the G20. So I said to him, you know, these people don't trust me. They think I'm some sort of, you know, like scared of the executive. You know, they just cast suspicion on my integrity. That's why I treat them the way I do. You can check with them and be pally-pally. Your integrity has never been questioned. Nobody has ever questioned in this parliament in all these years, but these guys decide I'm some sort of crook. So I say to Praveen, no, I am not ringing them. You speak to them directly because they'll think I'm spinning. Praveen asked for his number, he rang him. Then Jonas rang me back. And he told me that, you know what, it seems Mr. Lees is agreeable that we postpone the sitting for a while. So what happened is I've been in touch with Kule Mabe, at least you here, you can confirm. Praveen's not here. I spoke to you yesterday morning, well before I heard about this advert story. Then I spoke to you this morning. So I spoke to the whip. Now the proposal I've got, and having spoken to Mr. Lees now before we started, one is that we actually not sit with SAA today, this week, in the circumstances. Two, that we definitely sit on the 20th. Recall I was late, 6 minutes late, on Wednesday afternoon. And I told you, I met the minister and I spoke to him and I told him that the committee's view, as far as I know, unless it's changed, is one. If you do not deliver the annual financial statements by the 15th to Parliament, we are still going to call you and or, you or Jonas must be here, together with SA to explain to us why you can't do it. And then we're going to take decisions for you. He explained to me it's looking good, let's put it that way, that it'll be done by the 15th. So that's why I was late for the 6 minutes. Secondly, the DA has raised this question. Is it legally possible for the Speaker to sanction any public entity's annual report not being submitted on the letter? I think Frank sent me an email on Friday or something. I'll just ask Alan to forward that to you. That issue can also be discussed then. But on Friday morning, Frank Jenkins can take us through that, right? You've got it. Right? Just send it through now to them. You know, I didn't look at it, I haven't read it, it's irrelevant to me. It's a legal thing, it is his view on whether the Speaker does have the right to give extensions. So that issue can be discussed this Friday. The next thing to say is, I don't think this committee can be intimidated by the media. Those parties that think if they run to the media, then we're going to, you know, get intimidated. And, you know, like, hey, we've got to organize what they say. It won't happen under my watch. And I think the members here won't allow that. So on a specific merit, I do think, colleagues and comrades, that whether it's correct or not, it's in the public domain in the sense that the advert appears. It's unprecedented. I don't know of any example like this. I've checked tentatively with a lawyer, from Treasury though, I must say, so it's not very clear. Parliament can look into it. It doesn't transgress the PFMA. You can put the advert in. But when you get the money and you decide to go ahead, I think you will need approval in terms of the PFMA. But I'm not expert there, right? So basically, we are, to summarize where this committee is, to remind you, on the 18th of November, we met the SAA. There are some notes, there are fleeting exchanges. On SAA, I think our position as a majority, I'm not saying is one, that we think that the minister, the president, the ministry rather, and the department, the presidency, and SAA need to cooperate effectively in the interest of the country. Two, that this is a view of the committee that the board, the interim board, its term lapsed, I think, on the 1st of September. I think 1st of September. That we felt a new board should be appointed. As to who should serve on the board, that is the prerogative of the executive. But we feel the board should include people in managerial, aviation, financial, technical, and other relevant skills, as is required of any such airline, especially in the context that SAA finds itself. Three, that that's just 2 points that actually I said this, all parties are concerned about what's happening in SA. That's our formal position. Now, what I'm suggesting, I spoke to Mr. Lee, he'll speak for himself, is that we give it a few days. But I think where I would like us to come to an agreement on is that we can't wait. I think what we should do is, maybe tomorrow morning, I could work on a draft of a statement that explains the positions of the committee. Because really, we can't be silent on this matter. Along the lines that we want some sort of thing, and also urge the executive to understand that whether they deliver or not, we must have the SAA here with the ministry. Because I think we waited long enough. So a statement that communicates that we are concerned, that we really had it now from all sides, they must all wake up, and that we will is there media here, by the way? Whoever is monitoring, can I make this clear? This is merely my idea, so if you want to write about it, it's tomorrow. Okay? Because this is so I'll work on a draft, I'll let you have it sometime today. I've got many other things to do, maybe this evening. And then before you come to the meeting tomorrow, at least 2 hours before, you will get the draft tomorrow morning. So That is my proposal. Before anybody else, Mr. Lee, we'll come to the ESCOM issue in a moment. Do you want to say anything?
Is being treated as seriously as it clearly is being treated. So thank you very much to everyone, and I don't want to go into who in particular. So, but yeah, actually you in particular, thank you for taking it seriously. And clearly Friday meeting is not possible if the minister and deputy minister are out of the country. So that's fine. The question of a statement by the committee is that's the prerogative of the committee, and I think it's good that the committee takes a position. What I'm not entirely clear about, Mr. Chairman, is are you suggesting that we don't bring SAA and the minister in earlier than the 20th? We leave it at the 20th? Or because my discussions seem to indicate that perhaps next Tuesday would be a suitable date. Just some clarity on that, Mr. Chairman.
When the Deputy Minister phoned me, he didn't mention that. So if that's the case, then I can confer with via Cindy, or Ghost is here, and sort that out. Okay, that's something we can talk about tomorrow, because we look at the program as a whole. Good. The rest of the members, do you have anything to say? Is that a reasonable approach? Good. Then the other issue is, which I was going to raise anyway. Members, you will see what's happening in the last 48 hours. It's unseemly. This spat between ESCOM and Treasury, each is saying the other is basically, to put it mildly, misrepresenting what's going on. Now, the DA wrote to me this morning, to say that they are wanting a meeting, and then the UDM also contacted me now. And I said, no, I don't think there's a problem, but you see here again what I said to them at about 10:02 here. Is because ESCOM falls under public enterprises, I would prefer that we confer with public enterprises. Here too, something that struck me now, not saying I discussed it with them. I raised it with Mr. Mabe, ESCOM I forgot about, that actually what we do is maybe write a joint letter. Dipu can take it to a committee, I can bring it to say, look, we noticed this fact, and we're giving you a week or something to come to some sort of agreement on where things are, but in any case we're going to call you before the joint committees. Now, the thing is that we'll look for a date, which means throwing out the Twin Peaks poll, which we can do, and ensure that public enterprises and ourselves meet jointly. I don't think we should do this alone, because a state-owned entity belongs to public enterprises. And whatever happens, we meet before the quarter rises. That is the proposal I have, based on not the TA, actually my own views when I saw this thing emerging on TV last night. As it happens, the UDM and the DA have written to us, which is reasonable. But let's hear from because we've got a DA's letter. Can you forward? Did you send a letter to Alan? Alan, every letter that comes from them, just forward it. I mean, unless it's very sensitive. So he'll forward that to you now. Members from the ANC, do you want to say anything in reply to the broad? We can discuss this at our study group later at 5 p.m. or whenever. But in the meanwhile, Sir Peter,
if I was to start with the ESCOM matter, and please rule me out of order if I am, I would imagine if, for instance, as you are saying, and correctly so, that ESCOM falls under the Minister of Public Enterprises, right? And then you have got a national treasury wanting something from an SOE which belongs to DPE. Wouldn't it be the correct thing to do, right, for the Minister of Finance to interact with the Minister of Public Enterprises before we even come in? Because what we have heard now is officials speaking and so on, and there we go. We haven't given an opportunity to the two ministers to meet if there's a dispute of that nature. So I think the matter is serious, but I think we are jumping the gun. I think let's allow the two ministers to say we have failed on this thing, and then we can. Otherwise, we find ourselves managing departments and then SOEs. Thanks.
See, I think I agree with the approach that Comrade Chris is putting forward, because It will mean every time we'll be responding to media space and all other things. We're not going to manage the program of the committee through outside forces and other things. We must have our own program to deal with these things. And I think I would agree to what Swissa is saying. Let's give the Minister of Public Enterprise and Treasury to come together on some of these things and deal with this.
Sorry? Yeah, but we have to respond and have to get guidance. Now, let me explain. Firstly, both what Lefisa and Pinky are saying are covered, meaning when I said that we write to them to say sort this matter out, and we're giving you so many days. Secondly, if I'm correct, it's in the media that the Minister of, I heard it, in an interview with the Chief Procurement Officer, I don't know whether he said it, somebody said that the two ministers are going to meet. I saw an interview, or heard an interview and saw it on one of its news channels yesterday, where Kenneth Brown has been responding to ESCOM, but I didn't see any ESCOM person being interviewed at that stage, presumably a bit later, but I heard the statement. So what I think is clear is there's no contradiction between what Sifiso, Pinky, and I are saying. I will raise the matter with Dipur, and we'll discuss it further, and we'll come back on that matter. But I think we should also be consistent, colleagues. You see, we brought the Chief Procurement Officer here. In our regular reports, we've supported fully the Chief Procurement Officer to do his job. So this is not really a public, with due respect to Sifiso, you know, you're not here, but and Pinky, to the extent she shares that part. Yeah, yeah. So I'm saying that when you look at what we are doing, we have a stake as Treasury, because the Chief Procurement Officer is now a new model where all procurement is dealt with now under Treasury. That's a decision the Executive took, which we as the Parliamentary Committee supported. So this thing will come up. Every time there's a state-owned entity that's not cooperating with the Chief Procurement Officer, we are willy-nilly engaged. So we can't run away from that unless we now come to a position that we do not believe there should be a single Chief Procurement Officer. So we must be consistent. There's nothing inconsistent what Sifiso and Pinky are saying and I'm saying. That's how it's going to be done. I will confer with Dipur and we'll take it further. Is anybody else going to say anything? Thank you. Good. So tomorrow at 10:00.